Richard Martin's Wake Up Call podcast, presented every Monday and Friday, providing you with the truth and the facts. You decide.
Good day to you all, and welcome to the Wake Up Call on this Friday, January the 8th, 2016. I am Richard Martin, and I'm talking to you from Malaysia. Before we start, ladies and gentlemen, I have some pretty bad news for you. I reckon I have between 700 and 800 regular listeners on the Wake Up Call each show, and I've received so far a total of 8 subscriptions to donations to the Wake Up Call, despite what I have asked you please to bear in mind, which is that the Wake Up Call needs to pay for itself at this point after 10 years of an incredibly valuable source of information for yourselves that has come to you for free. I have explained that I need to derive an income from this. I have to say that if I cannot get a satisfactory income in a few weeks, the show will close. And as things are right now, if I have not received considerably more donations in the next few days, the show will close at the end of January. So I ask you, please, ladies and gentlemen, make an effort. Please understand that a source which has been provided to you for free does not necessarily mean that the value of that source is equivalent to its cost. I'm afraid it is difficult for you perhaps to understand that you will not find this information put together in the way that I do on a twice weekly basis anywhere else that I know of. And so I urge you to understand the importance and the value of what I talk to you about twice a week, and please act accordingly. Thank you so much. I will now move on to the talk of the day, which starts out with me showing you where Bernanke went so disastrously astray when developing his mad thesis that the insufficient provision of money was responsible for the Great Depression, and how the same mistakes have been made by Bernanke and his friends that they made back then. The same traps, the same errors, and now, frankly, the same results. You know, George Bush famously told an assembled group of congressional leaders in the aftermath of the Lehman filing that unless they immediately passed an open-ended Wall Street bailout, quote-unquote, this sucker is going down. They blindly complied. Yet for a while, it seemed of no avail. By the post-crisis bottom of the first quarter in 2009, household net worth had plunged from $68 to $55 trillion, or by nearly 20%. That reflected a 60% collapse in the stock averages and a 35% meltdown of housing prices. For a fleeting moment, it appeared that economic truth had come home to roost, that permanent gains in wealth and living standards could not be achieved by the kind of rampant speculation and debt-fueled financialization that had generated the phony boom of the Greenspan era. But that didn't reckon with the greatest and most unfortunate accident of modern financial history. The White House advisers who advised George Bush in September 2008 to violate the free market in order to save it had long ago proved their cluelessness about economic matters. They'd advised him to appoint Ben Bernanke to the Fed in 2002 and then to promote him to the post of chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in 2005 and finally to become head of the Fed in January 2006. But here's the thing. Bernanke was an academic hybrid of the two worst economic influences of the 20th century, the out-and-out statism of John Maynard Keynes and the backdoor statism of Milton Friedman's central bank-based monetarism. Both of these grand theoreticians got the causes of the Great Depression wrong, and Bernanke did doubly so. You could reduce all of his vaunted expertise about the 1930s to a single proposition. He basically claimed that the Fed should have bought up the entire $17 billion of government bonds outstanding at the time in order to liquefy the banking system and thereby arrest the plunge in economic output. That, ladies and gentlemen, is such BS. The reality is that the banking system collapsed because it was insolvent after the 15-year debt-fueled boom of World War I and the Roaring Twenties, not because it was parched for liquidity or because the Fed had been too stingy in the provision of reserves. In fact, money market interest rates barely exceeded 1% during the 1930-32 period when Friedman and Bernanke claim the Fed was too tight and excess, i.e. idle reserves in the banking system, soared by 15 times. This may be hard to believe in light of Bernanke's crazy, ignorant and misguided assertions, but there is no evidence anywhere that any solvent bank that was a member of the Federal Reserve System was denied discount loans, or that solvent mainstream business that wanted more credit couldn't get it. Instead, what happened was that the reckless expansion of bank credit during the years prior to the 1929 crash was liquidated because it couldn't be serviced or repaid. It was exactly the same story as what preceded the horror we are about to witness right now. The truth is that the politicians and money men don't want to admit this. They want to hide it from you. They need to hide it from you because you must not be allowed to know that they are committing the exact same mistakes they made back in the 1920s. At that time, total loans outstanding had grown from $15 to $40 billion during the preceding decade and a half, but much of it had gone into margin loans on Wall Street, real estate speculation, and massive overinvestment in US export and capital goods industries that collapsed once Wall Street financing of foreign customers dried up after the crash. Ladies and gentlemen, does this or does this not ring a very loud bell? So the money supplied measures as M1 shrunk by about 30% during the 3 years after the crash because bad loans were being liquidated and bank deposits extinguished. There was no disappearance of that Keynesian, either called aggregate demand. Rather, it was that of the phony wealth of the prior credit boom which inexorably evaporated. Needless to say, the events in the fall of 2008 had nothing to do with what actually occurred after the 1929 crash. Back then, the US was the world's powerhouse exporter and creditor. But like in China today, the apparent prosperity of the times depended upon vendor finance. In fact, with the help of the Federal Reserve, the US banking system and bond market had advanced the equivalent of $2 trillion in today's economic scale to foreign customers of US farmers and manufacturers. When the stock market bubble collapsed in October 1929, however, the Wall Street market in foreign debt went stone cold, triggering a cascade of worldwide defaults. By early 1933, the booming foreign debt market of the 1920s had become the subprime mortgage market of its day, with debt prices sinking to less than 10 cents on the dollar. US export customers had been borrowing new money in order to pay interest on their accumulating debts, but without access to new credits, they had no option but to curtail new orders drastically. Accordingly, US exports collapsed by 80% during the 3 years after the 1929 peak, leaving US industry stranded in excess capacity and overloaded with working inventories of raw materials, intermediate goods, and finished products. The finished product sector, for example, dropped from $40 to $18 billion, and capital spending dropped by 75% during 1930 to 33. Likewise, with the collapse of the stock market and the easy credit boom, sales of durable goods like autos, washing machines, and radios dropped by more than 70%. The Great Depression was not an avoidable mistake of the Fed during 1930 to 33, as Bernanke falsely claimed when he parroted Milton Friedman's erroneous history of the 1930s. It was the economic consequence of the unsustainable 1916 to 29 credit and financial bubble that had been fostered by the Fed. So Bernanke had it upside down as a historical matter and way out in left field as a contemporary policy matter. The grotesque absurdity of this ridiculous creature is that he was running around Washington in the fall of 2008 yelling that Great Depression II was at hand and preaching groundless hysteria. The fact is that at the time of the housing and mortgage bust, the US economy did not resemble that of 1929 in the slightest. There was not even a remote risk of the kind of industrial depression that had occurred in the early 1930s. You see, after 20 years of Greenspan Bernanke money printing and its pathetic copycat replication by China and the rest of the emerging market export mercantilist central banks, the US economy had been essentially deindustrialized. There was no risk whatsoever that the kind of capital spending reduction and inventory liquidation that had occurred in the early 1930s could possibly be replicated. And Bernanke knew it. Indeed, for a short period of time, the brunt of the industrial production adjustment occurred in China and the emerging markets. In effect, China and its supply chain had become the exporters or creditors of the present era. Thus, the post-crash Hoovervilles this time round were in the Chinese interior as 100 million migrant workers streamed home after suddenly being thrown out of work when world trade collapsed in the fall and winter of 2008-2009. Spending by US households after the 2008 crisis was bolstered by a surge of automatic income transfer payments for unemployment insurance, food stamps, Medicaid, Medicare, and other safety net programs, and by employment in the vast domestic service sector that, as an inherent structural matter, does not shut down to liquidate inventories because it has none. During a spending recession, service businesses shrink incrementally, not radically. Pilates instructors book less hours, but their studios don't go dark like overstocked factories. The global sector, massive importer, service-based deindustrialized welfare state that the US had become by September 2008, was the polar opposite of the 1930s economy that Bernanke so badly misunderstood in the first place. And for that reason, a classic industrial depression was never on the cards. To take one example, inventory liquidation during the Great Depression amounted to a 20% shrinkage of GDP, but only a 2% reduction during the Great Recession. In fact, the moderate liquidation of the excess inventories and payrolls that had built up during the Fed's unsustainable housing and credit boom was over and done by mid-2009. Indeed, the recession had cured itself even before the $800 billion Obama stimulus program or the Fed's massive quantitative easing maneuver had any measurable impact on the US economy. So the Bernanke lunatic money printing spree, which took the Fed's balance sheet from $900 billion on the eve of the crisis to $4.5 trillion, did not prevent any semblance whatsoever of a Great Depression too. What it did do, instead, was to inflate the mother of all financial bubbles. Not only was the phony household wealth that had been destroyed by the last crisis entirely recovered, but it has been increased by another $18 trillion to boot. Here's a statistic for you that blows the whole Bernanke lie right out of the water. Between the third quarter 2007 pre-crisis peak and the most recent quarter, household wealth, as measured by the Fed, soared by $18 trillion, or 24%, but labor hours have risen less than 0.5%. So, question for all you listeners, where did that $18 trillion come from, huh? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Or, more to the point, has the mainstream media ever, to your knowledge, broached that question or discussed that statistic with anyone? Likewise, labour productivity has stalled dramatically. Since the pre-crisis peak, non-farm business productivity has grown by only 1.1% annually, or at just half its historic 2.3% rate. Moreover, during the last 5 years, productivity has grown at just 0.4% per annum. What was the secret you missed, Ben Shalom Bernanke? Huh? What did you get so terribly wrong that we all had to suffer from your mad Frankenstein-style experiment with our money? Look, okay, let me be fair. There's obviously no way to quantify entrepreneurial activity per se. Indeed, the various facets of it, creative destruction, business innovation, and disruptive technological change, are crucial to capitalist prosperity precisely because they can't be quantified in recurring statistical series from the government's data mills. Nevertheless, Gallup has long tracked the birth, death, and net change in US business firms. And that trend is unequivocal. It had been heading south for many years, but it took a step change downward after the financial crisis, and it still has not recovered. Finally, it's just a plain fact of history and logic, and I've said it here over and over again, that without gains in real net investment, there can be no gain in real wealth. Yet real net investment in the US business economy today is 8% lower than at the 2007 peak and 17% below turn of the century levels. So how do you grow household wealth by $18 trillion in the face of these dismal world trends? In a word, with a printing press. But what happened last week is that Draghi showed that he's out of tricks and Yellen confessed that she's out of excuses. Yes, my friends and goodly faithful listeners, this sucker is indeed going down. And this time, all the misguided economics professors turned central bankers in the world will be powerless to reverse the plunge.
Share the truth. Invite others to listen to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. Richard Martin produces his shows single-handedly based on his extensive reading and research. Every week, Richard gives you the facts with no spin for you to make informed decisions on world events that will affect your life. Now, let's get back to today's show.
You know, many people have come to think of that if a financial crisis doesn't occur today or in the next few weeks, it simply isn't going to happen at all. The much-loved theory that we will be able to grow our way out of our difficulties and muddle through is a bit simplistic and much overused. People forget we are living in very unusual times and that no historic parallels exist to guide us forward. Hope that after some type of economic setback, the worst is largely behind us, is a poor strategy to embrace in confronting the challenges of tomorrow. As more money is poured into the system, lower interest rates at some point are no longer effective in driving the economy forward. As the extra GDP growth generated by each batch of loans drops, momentum ends. When the economic efficiency of credit collapses, many of the central bank's options quickly evaporate. The surreal feeling of indifference towards reality that has developed as to the limits of what central banks can do is very troubling. Companies have already ushered all the savings from interest paid on debt into the earnings column, and a major reason inflation remains low is that money has flowed into paper assets instead of tangibles. Many companies are sitting on a hoard of cash. This has lowered the velocity of money. Others exist on the mountain of debt. A strong shift could develop at any time and disturb the unnatural balance. When rates stop going lower or reverse, the positive effect will ebb and become a major headwind. With massive government debt in many countries and the economy still weak, this headwind will become devastating. This and other destabilizing factors have the potential to create the perfect storm. Welcome to the world your leaders have designed or allowed to form. Whether by design or merely as a byproduct of globalization, they have weaved a web of financial transactions that circle the globe. Now that they have wound up and distorted prices, we are facing the great unwinding, which will prove very painful. This event may be described in several ways, most likely as a collapse or realignment, but in reality, it is the recognition that America's path was an unsustainable illusion. Even during the Great Depression, there was population growth of the young, at least to maintain rising consumption. But this time round in the Greater Depression, the world faces overcapacity, too much debt, and fiat, and flat to declining young the world over, except Africa, only offset by the liability that is the rapidly rising older population. Welcome to the new abnormal, which nobody in positions of power will acknowledge. There is no resolution of this. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've seen the stock market collapse over the last few days, led by China, no less, which has gone limit down by 7% on 2 days. And the poor, wretched Chinese, those immature and very, very, very naive market operators, are now in the business of imprisoning anybody who tries to sell shares, let alone sell short. They have a very powerful and unpleasant lesson to learn, I'm afraid. As in the case of the West, China will have to deleverage its enormous debt burden before it can even start thinking of rebuilding its economy, which is precisely what they all seek to deny loudly and boisterously, not only as if a recovery were feasible without dealing with the debt, but even as if more debt could mean more recovery. Their debt deleveraging will involve such stupendous amounts of largely virtual money that the situation, the bottom, from which rebuilding will need to take place, will be one at which today's societies will be hardly recognizable anymore. Debt deleveraging comes with deflation. Spending will plummet, unemployment will shoot up, production will grind to a halt. Power will shift from established political and economic parties to others. Obviously, this will not be a smooth transition. The clarions of war sound in the distance already. What is crucial to realize is that none of it can be prevented, other than theoretically the warfare. The economic parts of the play must be staged. All we can do is to make it as bearable as possible. The people on the streets, as always, will bear the brunt of the downfall. We only need to look at Greece today to get a pretty good idea of how these things play out. It won't be all straight down from here, but the trend will be crystal clear. It didn't start all of a sudden today, but China's double circuit breaker is a useful sign, if not an outright red flag. One thing's for sure, China will make the history books. So can you believe 2016 just started and already people are calling for a bigger police state where the government can kill citizens without due process, charge or trial? It seems that many on the internet want another Waco, a lethal federal government show of force for the Obama age. You know, to keep the right-wingers, pro-gun nuts, anti-government types, patriots and conspiracy theories at bay. Agree or disagree, with the Oregon military standoff over federal land issues still underway, people across social media are escalating things sharply. Numerous voices are calling for a literal bloodbath in Oregon and the exercise of unilateral government power to kill the individuals involved, including supporters. It is an armed and highly charged but so far peaceful situation that is nonetheless rooted firmly in civil disobedience and principle. But that hasn't stopped opponents from calling for them to be treated like domestic terrorists. Twitter users across the globe and across the political spectrum have been calling for the use of lethal force to end the standoff. You see, this is the country I'm so hard trying to pull you out of. A bunch of angry, disillusioned people that will more and more clamour for the use of violence to solve the problems of the world. This is very scary, and it should be flashing red lights right into your eyes. But I fear it will not do so. So if you're wondering just what will be the cause of the stock market collapse, you can call it a double whammy. Corporate executives will be drastically curtailing their injection of cash into the casino because they will not be able to borrow as readily, if at all, to buy back shares and fund mergers and acquisition deals. At the same time, the sovereign wealth funds will be disgorging the windfall profits that they had temporarily parked in the casino in order to compensate for the drastic plunge in current cash flow. Even if profits do not continue to fall beyond the 15% drop already recorded for GAAP earnings during the LTM period just ended, corporations have run out of excuses for sustaining the massive multiple expansion that has occurred during the last several years. This doesn't even take into account the immense pressure that will be coming from recessionary forces hammering reported profits in the time-worn manner. So talk about a difference between fantasy and reality. It was just a few weeks ago that the International Monetary Fund predicted that Saudi Arabia would likely be bankrupt within the next 5 years. Saudi Arabia's financial position is deteriorating rapidly, and the government's burning through cash like a coked-up rock star. Just a few months ago, the Saudi king visited the United States. When he touched down in his private jet, he had a massive convoy of dozens of luxury vehicles waiting to whisk him away to the Four Seasons, where he'd rented out the entire hotel for his stay. Bankruptcy be damned. The Saudis followed this up with plans now to build the world's tallest skyscraper, which would stand a full kilometre in height. Seriously, what are these people thinking? What kind of idiot goes out of his way to blow through cash when he's rapidly going broke? Why, the United States of America, of course. Senator Lankford of Oklahoma recently released a scathing report of what he called federal fumbles and absolutely ridiculous wastes of money. The report would be hilarious if it weren't true and funded with your own tax dollars, including $374,087 to study senior citizen dating habits, $545,000 to teach members of Congress how to answer questions, and $4 million per rebel to train fighters in Syria. Of course, one of my favourites, which isn't even in the report, is the federal government's policy on peanuts and many other agricultural products.
U.S. federal law requires the government to pay American peanut farmers when the price of peanuts goes below a certain level. With the peanut market in a serious slump this year, this means that the industry is likely to require some $2 billion in bailout funds. The sad part about this is that the government is required to buy the crop at a price that dramatically exceeds the market price of peanuts. In other words, taxpayers are guaranteed to lose money on this deal because the government is happy to overpay. It reminds me of all the classic stories we heard after the fall of the Soviet Union about government incompetence. My favourite was about the Soviet boot factory that only made left boots but no right boots. It's hard to find much of a difference these days. Are these governments so different and special that they can go on spending indefinitely and without consequence? Like spending $43 million of taxpayer funds to build a gas station in Afghanistan that no one around could use? Or building a multi-billion dollar skyscraper right after being informed that you're going bankrupt? The IMF has singled out Saudi Arabia and hung a giant countdown timer over the nation's economy. Given that the IMF is a lapdog of the US government, you'll never see them do the same in the West. But the circumstances are just as obvious. US federal debt now stands at nearly $19 trillion, after an astonishing $674 billion debt increase just last month. It's pretty clear where this is going. And no, nothing dramatic is going to happen today or tomorrow. But now is definitely the best time to make sure you have a plan B in place. The most severe consequences could play out for quite a while, but it's hard to imagine that you'll be worse off for taking sensible steps to ensure you are not a victim of such colossal government stupidity. So, 73% of whites said they get angry at least once a day. You can hear it in tirades on talkback radio and in snarling cable news editorials. Anger is the dominant characteristic of a new industry of online news providers and of the commentary of the bloggers and social media hawks who are informed by it. You can detect white conservative anger in the militia takeover of a federal government office in Oregon this past weekend, in the constant passage of ever freer gun laws in Texas, in resentment towards the Black Lives Matter movement, in Fox News's endless war against the imaginary war on Christmas. Most obviously, you can hear it in the cheering at the rallies of conservative outsiders running for the White House, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. A new survey by NBC News with SurveyMonkey and Esquire claims to have quantified this anger, or at least proven that it is a real phenomenon. The survey finds that overall 49% of Americans said they find themselves feeling angrier now about current events than they were 1 year ago. Whites are the angriest, with 54% saying they have grown more outraged over the past year, compared with 43% for Latinos and 33% for African Americans. 73% of whites said they get angry at least once a day, compared with 66% of Hispanics and 56% of blacks. The poll found also that Republicans were angrier than Democrats, with 61% of Republicans saying they were made angry once a day by current events, compared with 42% of Democrats. In the wake of the Great Recession and the long, slow, non-existent economic recovery from it, the cause of the anger is hardly a shock. Over half of respondents, that's 54%, say that their financial situation is worse than they thought. According to the Real Clear Politics average of national polls, 65.7% of Americans believe the nation is heading in the wrong direction. So, on September the 4th, 1993, President Clinton spoke about the American dream in a weekly radio address. He told his audience that, quote unquote, in America, the idea is that if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll be rewarded with a good life for yourself and a better chance for your children. That's what America used to stand for, and indeed much of the Western world. Freedom, truth, hard work and fair play, building a better life. But those ideals have all but faded now, displaced by a new normal of war, debt, government surveillance, freedom-killing bureaucracy, and a monetary policy that decimates responsible, hard-working people for the benefit of a tiny elite. In his year-end commentary in the Washington Post, writer George Will summed up 2015, citing example after example of government overreach and excess. The value of property seized by the US federal government through civil asset forfeiture exceeded the value of property stolen by burglars and thieves. Florida police raided a mahjong game played by four women aged 87 through 95 because they were, gasp, betting with their own money. New Jersey police arrested a 72-year-old retired schoolteacher for illegally carrying a firearm, a 300-year-old flintlock pistol he had purchased from an antique dealer. A 9-year-old in Florida was threatened with sexual harassment charges for writing love notes to a girl saying that her eyes sparkled like diamonds. George Will's list, of course, barely scratched the surface of the tip of the iceberg. 2015 was the year that the middle class was officially vanquished in the land of the free, with its share of the population falling to just 50%. US federal debt reached nearly $19 trillion in 2015, an increase of almost $750 billion during the calendar year. The US government published over 80,000 pages of new regulations, making it nearly impossible to understand the rules, let alone play by them. 2015 also saw the passing of incomprehensibly terrible laws, including the USA Freedom Act, which restored many of the worst parts of the Patriot Act that were set to expire. Then there was the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, passed at the end of the year, which officially turns the land of the free into a gigantic information-sharing surveillance state. And of course, the 2015 spending bill, which, as of last week, allows the US government to strip you of your passport if they believe that in their sole discretion you owe them money. These are hardly the actions of a solvent, trustworthy government or a nation that's on the right track. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that this story doesn't have a happy ending. We can pretend that this time is different, that the country is different, that there is some special source that allows this government to run massive imbalances forever. But deep down, we all know the truth and where this is headed. I've read no shortage of apocalyptic predictions suggesting that 2016 is the year of the dollar collapse, or the global economic collapse, or something else that invariably ends in the word collapse. I don't necessarily believe that. First, no one can credibly answer the question of when. Governments have surprised us all with their uncanny ability to kick the can down the road and delay the repercussions of their folly. But I don't really think the question of when is relevant. Nearly every major Western government is insolvent. Entire monetary and financial systems are insolvent. Governments have destroyed their own middle classes, giving rise to the greatest wealth gap that has existed since the Great Depression and even before. The risks are obvious, and you either stick your head in the sand and ignore them, or you take steps to reduce their impact on your life. It's like anything else. If you live in a wildfire zone, you get fire insurance. And you'll never be worse off for having good coverage on your home to protect your family. Having a plan B just makes sense, doesn't it? Regardless of whether a major disaster occurs in 2016, next year, or even never. We can't see the future. We can only see the risks today. Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Develop a plan B that addresses those risks, and you'll never have to worry about the future again. And God knows I've given you enough advice, enough warning, enough ideas. I've even taken you across the world to see another place where things are very different. So please, ladies and gentlemen, start off. Please let me have some donations from you, and then listen carefully to what I have to say, and let's get this thing on the road, moving in the right direction, and you, please, out of harm's way. Well, unfortunately, the fall was largely due to what they called a processing error, which was huge even by government standards. So therefore, not only will GDP estimates for the current quarter sink, so will reported GDP from prior quarters. Downward revisions to construction spending are coming, and the GDP reports will reveal just by how much. So this is way beyond "if you see something, say something." In a series of pamphlets circulated among local governments in the United Kingdom, British parents are now being encouraged to spy on their own children and to report any instances of possible radicalisation. Of course, this advice comes with a nifty set of instructions for how to spot a terrorist in your home. The first three signs: out of character changes in dress, behaviour, and changes in their friendship group. Losing interest in previous activities and friendships. Secretive behaviour and switching screens when you come near. Imagine that. A teenager who doesn't want mum and dad to see what's going on his iPhone. Or a 14-year-old who starts dressing differently and hanging out with a different group of friends. Funny, this sounds like pretty much every teenager on the planet. But even more unsettling are these. Showing a mistrust of mainstream media reports and belief in conspiracy theories. Appearing angry about government policies, especially foreign policy. So apparently now questioning the propaganda and government policies are considered evidence of subversive extremist behaviour. If you don't fall in line, you're a radical. And the government now wants to train parents to rat out their own children. Ladies and gentlemen, this is chilling, disgusting, and unfortunately not too surprising from the country that was the backdrop for George Orwell's 1984. Orwell's dystopic view of the future is rapidly becoming reality in many countries across the West. The endless government monitoring of all electronic communication is prevalent everywhere in the free world, so-called. Financial privacy has been destroyed. Banks are now merely unpaid spies of bankrupt governments, and they will freeze you out of your life savings in a heartbeat if some faceless bureaucrat orders them to do so. Civil asset forfeiture, where police and government agencies confiscate your cash and property without the slightest bit of due process, is at an all-time high. So much, in fact, that the government theft from its citizens, as I just said, is greater than that perpetrated by private criminals. Governments have even shown an alarming willingness to confiscate your own children if they deem in their sole discretion that you are an unfit parent, which may now include, obviously, subversive behaviour like questioning authority. Now, in Britain, they want to turn the tables and have parents spy on the children. So the Ministry of Truth and Ministry of Love, it appears, are alive and well. Yes, there have been some terrible tragedies lately. But governments are using these attacks as a way to tap into people's most carnal fears, however unlikely they may be. As I've observed to you all before, ladies and gentlemen, you're more likely to choke on a hot dog than die in a terrorist attack. But they'll never spend trillions on a war against hot dogs, because hot dogs aren't as scary as the image of an angry brown teenager with a head wrap and an AK-47 climbing across a set of monkey bars in a terrorist training camp. Governments stole this fear and use it to award themselves even more power in the name of protecting you. Now they're encouraging you to violate the most sacred bonds of family as some sort of duty to the state. Look, I have no doubt that there's an army of bureaucrats out there who feel they have an honourable burden to keep people safe. And they're going to do whatever they think they can do to protect us. This sort of idea would have been unimaginable not too long ago, the stuff of North Korea or the Soviet Union. Yet today it seems perfectly acceptable, especially to young people who have known nothing different. It's an incredible reminder of how the free world is now ruled by irrational paranoia, as opposed to the principles of liberty upon which it was founded. And that's my country, ladies and gentlemen, the United Kingdom of Great Britain, fallen into this ghastly, devastating trap. It's been so long, so many decades since I've lived there, that it's hard to reconcile my memories with the facts of today. So China really is going down. The China Beige Book, which is much more accurate, recently showed that across the board economic conditions are unravelling. There will be no soft landing in China. It will bring down the entire world's unprecedented debt and real estate bubble. and it's only a matter of time, and likely only a month away at this point. All the old tricks of the trade, tried and trusted, are in place. Rampant, massive speculation, an internal collapse utterly ignored by the government, which encourages even more speculation, humongous buying up of property in the high end of the top coastal cities in English-speaking countries, like they'll never go down and like they can't get enough. We're talking Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Auckland, Singapore, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Vancouver, Toronto, New York, and London. These markets are considered Teflon-proof. They are not. In fact, they're some of the greatest bubbles that exist today. China's leading cities, like Shanghai, Beijing, and Shenzhen, are up 700% or more since 2000. Bear in mind that Chinese real estate has been slowing and prices falling for over a year. That is precisely why China's stock market bubbled up 160% in less than 1 year. When Chinese investors realized they could no longer make easy money in the real estate bubble, they turned to stocks. And after the dumb money piled in, the Shanghai Composite Index fell 42% in just 2.5 months. It's checkmate for them, I'm afraid. And, by association, for the entire world. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, that means you. Money out of the banks, please. Out of any and all assets, into treasuries and short positions in the stock market. Yes, you can do that through ETFs in IRAs. Do it now. Look, ladies and gentlemen, don't misunderstand me. I am not unmindful of those who have contributed, the 8 people that have done their best to donate. I am immensely grateful to all of you for having shown solidarity and loyalty towards me. I really, really appreciate your efforts. Believe me, I will appreciate the efforts of anybody that comes forward and donates. But at this point, you have to do this. I really am sorry. I feel very embarrassed. I feel very uncomfortable having to speak this way. This is not my usual manner of talking. But frankly, it needs to happen. So please, please, ladies and gentlemen, do your best. So more outrages that took place in 2015. It was revealed that the Pentagon had no idea what it did with $8.5 trillion, lost track of $500 million worth of weapons and equipment, and spent $43 million on a single gas station in Afghanistan. A DIA report released in June intimated the military was aware of the rising threat of ISIS and not only allowed it, but welcomed it. The program to train moderate rebels in the fight cost $500 million, but yielded only 4 or 5 fighters. Further, multiple generals spoke out this year about the US military's role in creating ISIS. Additionally, news broke in 2015 that one ISIS recruiter had previously been trained by infamous Iraq war profiteer Blackwater. Ron, are you still with us? Ron, by the way, is the listener who wrote in to say that I had been less than convincing about the need to leave the United States. Are you managing to put it all together and conjure up a picture of a rogue nation causing havoc and chaos all over the planet, Ron? Are you getting it that your countrymen are sleaze that are knocking on all the doors in hopes of breaking the house down and taking it over? That your country is truly the hideous creature that all wars were meant to prevent and destroy? Do you realise it's only a matter of time before the big comeuppance comes your way? Okay, Ron, I'll keep on trying. But the job just becomes bleaker and bleaker as time goes by. So, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of another show, and it is time to wish you a wonderful weekend and all the best, hoping that the weather measures up for you and that we will be refreshed, right, and ready to come back for another week. Start Monday.
And there you have it. You decide.